Hello once again, ladies and gentlemen. We were asked by the lovely co-hosts, Diego and Michael, to appear on Saints and Sinners. You remember that we had Diego on not too long ago, and they asked us to be on their show, so what you are going to get today is an episode where we went on Saints and Sinners, and they asked us a bunch of questions about economics, and, well, without further ado, let's jump right on in into that episode.
So what's up, guys?
Well, yep.
Nope, nothing much. Awesome. So like we said before, we wanted to talk about at least the five myths, you know, individually, you guys pick your own, but some of the myths revolving around people's stigmas or beliefs towards the economy or economics. Maybe it's about time we started working on trying to break that spell. So we have you two beautiful people on to try to help do that. So go ahead, take the ball, man. Run with it. Well, Christian's broken up. Kim, you do it.
All right, so we are starting with number five, correct?
Number five, that's right.
All right, so now I had so high taxes on the rich will solve problems. Well, unfortunately, here we go. This is why this does not work. So, we've all heard that somehow taxing the top 1% is somehow going to save our economy. I cannot do a Bernie Sanders. Well, other than the fact that if you try to tax, say, the rich at like the highest rates possible, say even like if we try like 90%, you know, the rich may not want to pay that because really, do you want to get price gouged that much? But also, there's a problem with these people didn't get rich just because, you know, they put their money under a pillow of some sort. What they most likely did to become rich and continue to be rich is invest their money, especially some of the people they invested in, like some a business, something like that, something that will continue to grow their money. So a lot of their assets will come into making a business that also produces things for consumers to buy. Therefore, when they make the money in that, some of the money that they make goes into, of course, going into growing their business into the stuff that they produce. They set their price just above production rate so that whenever they sell things to consumers, so they start to make more money doing that. And of course, the government, of course, they still have to pay the taxes from their business and all that good stuff. So when you're trying to tax the rich, it's not like the rich is just sitting there on their like piles and piles of money just laying on the stuff. They're investing it, they're saving it, and they're also doing stuff so they can continue to grow money. So when you're trying to sit here and tax the rich, it's not like they're just sitting around on that. So you're also hurting the consumers who are buying these products. And so now that you're trying to damage all of this, and the fact that even if you try to tax all of the rich people, we do not have enough rich people to pay for our gigantic deficit at this point.
So you couldn't eat the rich and still pay for everything? Is that what you're saying, Tim?
Yeah, no, we could not. Because it's just the fact that the rich people just didn't get rich because they were some sort of greedy people and went around smacking people upside the head with a club and stealing their money. They were smart, they invested, and we benefit from the fact that they make a lot of the products that consumers buy. So who are we really hurting here? And the fact is, if you went around trying to tax people at high rates, are they bound to stay here? I mean, what if they just tried leaving? Like, we can't just keep them here.
That seems to be the argument that that I have all the time with pro-Bernie people, is what are you going to do the day that they just up and decide, we're not going to do this anymore, and they just leave the country? Because we saw it with Burger King, right?
Yeah, I went to
pretty
Canada,
recently,
right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I completely agree.
All right, Christian.
Okay, so the idea behind this myth is that recessions are caused when people just suddenly decide that they don't want to consume anymore. And it goes kind of through the myth of demand side economics that says it's people that spending drives the economy and not saving and production. So the idea about this is when there's a gap, how much people used to spend compared to what they spend now, that the government needs to come in and spend a bunch of money, run up a bunch of deficits to fix the problem. Now, what's really caused by the problem of underconsumption is the fact, normally it happens in a cyclical kind of recession where prices seem to fall in certain industries relative where they used to be, and then people want to save their money. Or, you know, the previously booming industries that have been laid off now don't have as much money to spend, so of course they have to save. And in reality, what causes the depression and the deflation to happen is people saving their money in order to put it back to instances or products that they value more. So what happens is the previously overvalued goods have to become liquidated, and that the economy at large has to use saving or newfound saving because of the lower prices to reestablish the capital structure and to really liquidate all the money. Now, the problem is here, when the government's going to spend a whole lot of money to fill in that gap, what that does is it just further screws out the depression to hit rock bottom, and it further screws out
You're breaking up bad, Christian.
Covering here?
Nope, I didn't hear anything. I just know that you asked. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay, hang on. Let me switch Wi-Fi that I'm on real fast.
Sure. All right. Let's talk a little bit while he's doing that. Let's talk, Kim, about your podcast when you start doing it.
About four.
You guys are on episode 16 now, right?
So yeah.
You're doing at least once or two a week.
Yeah, about, what's it, like four, 3 months ago, maybe? Something like that. I think I might have started it maybe a week or two after, I think, Christian had decided that he wanted to Skype with a few people in the JSP group just to talk about, you know, maybe the daily news and just have actual conversations with people instead of just text stuff. And I was like, and me and him started talking. I was like, man, this guy's got a great personality and no shit. So I decided that.
I wish I could say the same
about that.
And then so I just was like, oh man, I want to start a podcast where I can just like pick his brain and gather more knowledge. And then he was like, all right. And he would co-host, and so thanks to his thirst for knowledge, it caught on fire, like, in my mind, and being in competition with his huge brain caused me to, like, jump into all the economics and everything possible, and thanks to him, I've just, like, consumed a shit ton of knowledge.
I love shit ton of knowledge.
So
I'm back.
Oh.
Yay! You can curse all you want. So.
Oh, sorry, because I just said a whole lot of curse words just then.
Yeah.
Oh, forget it.
Do you guys just want me to start my whole point over? Because now that I've said it once, I can find a better way to say it.
Yeah, I would go back about a minute and a half into what you were saying, to be honest, and just try to go from there or start over. It doesn't matter, man.
I think I'm going to start over.
Do it.
Okay, so my number five myth is that progressives and Democrats or liberals seem to believe that the government can fix recessions caused by an underconsumption slash fall in an aggregate demand. And this goes into the belief that recessions and economic slowdowns and depressions are caused by basically the animal spirits. It's a very Keynesian belief. And what they think is when people just stop spending money, that that's what hurts the economy. But they don't really look at the before. They don't really look at, well, why aren't these people spending as much money? And the reason they're not spending as much money is because either they've been laid off because they were previously employed in an industry that was part of an artificial boom, or they just see prices falling and they'd rather save money for other projects, or they think they see at the state of the economy, or they may be worried about their future prospects. So they withdraw their consumption of present goods and save for the consumption of future goods. Now, the reason that it shows up in the Keynesian numbers that the economy is slowing down and the money's not circulating. And because people are laid off, this is de facto diagnosed as a problem. So what the solution is, we're just going to get the government to come in and make up for the lack of spending, whether through government projects or bailouts or whatever. And the government's going to inject a bunch of money and it's going to get in people's pockets and they're just going to spend again. Now, the problem with this is that when a recession happens, people need to let their savings reestablish the capital structure in the first place and liquidate the malinvestments. Otherwise, it just takes longer for the recession to actually take its course, and it takes longer, and it pushes the recovery down the road. And not only does it push the recovery down the road, it also skews up what where the recovery should happen. So it could create a new little mini kind of artificial boom where everyone thinks it's okay, or a horizontal movement, only to be shown that industries weren't really profitable just because the government came in and spent money. They just got a little bit of juice, and they you know, either saved that money, or you see businesses pocketing bailout money. So the reality is that, one, recessions aren't even caused by a lack of consumption or a fall in aggregate demand, because spending is not what drives the economy. And the only thing that government does by injecting itself into a recession to fix the consumption is it just skews up the recovery in the first place. And, you know, Chad Thayer says it skews up the deleveraging, and it's like peeling off a Band-Aid instead of ripping it off, because politically, the government just wants to tell people what they want to hear and make their lives a little bit more cushy and, quote, soften the blow. But in fact, if the blow is not softened, it just it sets yourself up for a more solid and fundamental growth down the road. So government can't fix recessions caused by underconsumption. All they can do is make the numbers say what they want. But it really can't. It really just gets in the way of the real economic factors trying to relocate where the profitable industries are.
Oh, that's great. I hope anybody listening at this point right now, if you get to this point and you have any further questions, you know, you can always send it to them. And I'm sure you guys would be happy to give them any feedback if they were confused on anything they heard. You know, I mean, it makes sense, but if anybody's listening, I'm saying on my end, I want to almost send them to you so that you can flesh out any questions that they have, if that's all right with you guys.
I actually have a question for you, Christian.
Okay.
So we talked about it a couple weeks ago. I saw on online that the U.S. is predicted to have the fastest economic recovery in what is like a century. That I had read in passing online, and I know that obviously, like, that's not right. Right, it's like we've had the slowest economic recovery in like 70 something years, but I'm not economically like savvy, I guess. So what do you like, how would you address that, for as far as we're gonna have the best economic growth in 100 years?
I mean, well, if I go out tonight with my girlfriend, I might tell her, oh, this is gonna be the best date we're ever gonna have ever. You know? That's just me blowing smoke.
It's gonna be the weatherman.
Like the weatherman might say that it's gonna snow on Thursday. I mean, that doesn't make it true. I haven't seen the numbers they're looking at, but the reality is, if it's coming from the left, it's most likely coming from a very, very Keynesian outlook. And the Keynesians would say that, you know, low interest rates it's gonna spur the economy and it's gonna create all this growth. Well, why have we had like 7 years of near zero interest rates and even the Keynesians admit that they haven't seen the inflation that they want, and they haven't really seen growth that they want. Now you could get into it and say, you know, me and some of the people that I've been talking to kind of, well, you know, we have had the inflation, we've had a lot of inflation, but the low interest rates and the seemingly low inflation would really have you believe that we're still in a very, very deflation environment, and without the Fed coming in and pumping in a lot of money into the economy and the government doing what it did, you would see us in the middle of a very, very downward recession. I think we're still in a recession. It's just going to take for the everything to kind of hit the fan, or just for the emperor to be found that he has no clothes before people actually realize this. And honestly, it's really sad, because if the Fed and the government would have done nothing, we probably would be in a very rapid recovery right now, because it would lay the foundation for growth and not just another bubble or a peeling off of a deleveraging, or, you know, trying to give the economy surgery by making it take a bunch of tequila shots.
Right. So there's another hangover in the waiting for us, Ted.
Well, we could still be in it. We could still be in a hangover. The problem is we could just be so numb to it because we're kind of just meandering along, whereas if the money supply wasn't being inflated the way it is and interest rates weren't as so low as they are, we would see us being in a very, very steep downward spiral.
Oh, man. Maybe one of these days we'll have to have Christian, me and you, at some point, have a podcast on the business cycle. That's going to be a fun one.
Oh, we should do that. I just got to get one more thing in. Is, you know, the Austrians would kind of point this out when they say that the interest rate's low, and since it's lower than we know it would already be, just because you think, oh, we haven't seen any inflation from last year or the year before, that doesn't mean that the money supply is inflated to where it otherwise would be. It's basically unseen inflation, but we can move on now.
No, I'm just thinking about it. Sorry. I got caught up thinking about it. All right, let's roll to number four for you guys, right?
Yeah, I'll just make sure we're on four.
Yeah, okay. We're on four.
Oh.
Let's count it down.
So, all right, so I'm pretty sure, especially on the left, you've heard of a theory called trickle-down economics. So let me go ahead and give you there's a definition that I'm going to read to you, and it's provided by How Stuff Works. And I'm going to give you the definition. Here it is. In a nutshell, trickle-down theory is based on the premise that within an economy, giving tax breaks to the top earners makes them more likely to earn more. Top earners invest extra money in productive economic activities, spend more of their time at the high-paying trade they do best, whether that be creating inventions or performing heart surgeries. Either way, these activities will be productive, reinvigorate economic growth, and in the end, generate more tax revenue from these earners and the people they've helped. According to the theory, this boost in growth will ultimately help those in lower income brackets as well. Although trickle-down economics is often associated with the policies of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, the theory dates back to the 1920s. The name also has roots in the 20s when humorist Will Rogers coined the term, saying the money was all appropriated for the top in the hopes it will trickle down to the needy. And what I'm going to tell you is that's bullshit. That shit is not actually true. Trickle-down economics is a myth. It doesn't make any sense. They are lying to you when they tell you something called trickle-down economics works. If you check any volume of any economics book, there is no such thing as trickle-down economics. They're just making shit up right there. It's not a theory. It's not taught anywhere. It doesn't exist. That is something the left is telling you to throw against the right to get you incensed, but it literally is not a theory. Like, it makes no sense. It does not exist.
Wow.
Yeah, I also had trickle-down.
What?
Go ahead, man. Go ahead.
Trickle down was on my list too. It was actually number one on mine, but there's a lot of things there. There's the notion that the rich don't hoard their money and they do put it in productive means, especially the very wealthy. They do invest it. But the difference is, you know, the leftists and the Keynesians who supposedly denounce trickle down economics, like, oh, trickle down economics doesn't really work. Well, then what the heck is a bailout? It's like, if you're going to bail out all these large businesses in the hope that they get things going and provide jobs to people and blah, 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 well, you're subscribing to trickle-down economics. And the point is, I mean, when you have to confront it like this, it's kind of a straw man, but the reality is reducing taxes on anyone has some sort of positive economic growth. If you reduce taxes on the rich, you're going to have more economic growth. If you reduce taxes on the poor, you're going to have more economic growth. But the idea that, and I heard defined one time that a reduction in trickle-down economics makes the rich more likely to share their profits with their employees. That's not true. What happens is when you reduce taxes and when you reduce the parasitic relationship of government over the economy in any form or fashion, you have an increase in productivity that does benefit the poor. But it's an increase in productivity, and it's not the money that's being saved directly trickling down to people. It's kind of a bastardization of economics, and it's really a straw man that And they'll also paint it this way. They say, oh, well, you think that giving subsidies to rich corporations is going to benefit the poor as well. Of course, subsidies doesn't benefit the poor, but subsidies aren't tax breaks. So I would say, well, tax breaks for everyone has a positive effect on the economy and not just the rich.
Right, but that might address more of the mentality of like, which I feel like the U.S. is kind of taking over now, where it's like this socialist mentality. Let me qualify that, but it's the idea that I'm doing poorly because you're doing better. I kind of see it like that. Like they think that they're doing poorly, so they should take from the rich too. I don't think they realize that they're pitting people against each other, and I think it's the wrong way to look at it from just a human perspective, not in an economic sense like you just described.
Well, that'd be the fixed pie fallacy, too. The idea that there's only a set amount of wealth in the economy, and if someone else has more, then someone else has less. But that's not true. The idea is that to make the pie bigger, so even if you have a smaller piece of the pie, your piece has still grown because the sheer mass of the pie has grown.
What was that?
It's a great point. I've never thought about it like that. It's a great point.
What's that expression you used the last time with the tie? Do you remember that? It was so nice. I can't remember it.
With the what?
You used an example in a similar context of.
Oh, okay. Yeah. A rising tide lifts all boats.
There we go. I like that. All right. So that was number four. Let's do number three, shall we, Kim? All right. Kim's dead.
I was here. Sorry. So I think, middle class is losing, which also is incorrect. So there was this article they sent out that was all from the Pew Research that said the middle class is losing. However, the Pew Research, if you actually looked at some of the graphs, what they were missing there was that the 11% they were looking at, actually about 7% of that was actually moving upward. What we were seeing was that the old middle class was actually moving upward into the higher classes. So the old middle class is actually moving up. So the fact was we were actually seeing more success of people moving upward. So what they were telling you was that the middle class is actually losing upward. So I'm not seeing it. But they were giving you skewed scale. So the middle class is actually succeeding and finally moving up. So I have no idea where they're getting their research. But if you go and look, Financial Times actually had an article, and you can look it up, December 9th, 2015, Financial Times, has this awesome sliding graph from 1971 to show you the income. And it's coming from like about the baby boomer generation, of just people who just had to steadily do, like, jobs, I mean, like, trades and all of that, that just had to work their way from, you know, the lower class to the middle class and finally started to gradually work their way up higher. So all of the stuff they're giving you about the middle class starting to disappear is because they're moving upward, not downward.
That's great. And you did an article too for the Jason Stapleton program. So we're going to put that in the show notes. If you want to send me that article as well that you just referenced, I'll put it in. Christian, same for you. If you have any articles you want to put, I'm going to put it on the show notes so everybody can see it. And you'll be able to find anything that, you know, hopefully most of the stuff, I'll put it there. Most of the stuff that we're talking about, we'll try to put it in the show notes. So go ahead, man.
I'm going to have to start writing some articles.
Yeah.
You really do. You really do. It's a waste.
Yeah, be using that beautiful brain. I will read those articles.
It's so sad. Get on it, man. Are you ready, brother?
Yeah, I'm good.
No, you should be.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so number four, well, my number four, it was raising the minimum wage doesn't have an average.
Can you hear me? No, it is number three, but no. Well, Kim went first for number
Well, because his, my number four was his number one, and right about now his number four is going to be my number one. So we have some that kind of went together.
Remember, we're on three. Do your number three, man.
All right, so number three, I'm just going to call it number three. Raising the minimum wage doesn't have an adverse effect on unemployment or employment, either way. So the idea here is that they will show you all these statistics, and they say, well, we raised the minimum wage 50 cents, and you didn't see a whole lot of firings or whatever. And they'll also pull up a bunch of data, and they'll talk to employers, and they'll say, well, did raising the minimum wage have an effect on you? And they say, well, no, I didn't really fire anyone, but of course, they didn't really hire anyone either. But the difference is 3 or 4 years down the road, these people that they're interviewing are the businesses that survived the minimum wage hike. So it's like interviewing all the survivors of Russian roulette and saying, oh, is it dangerous? And the survivor saying, well, no. So anyway, what happens is when you raise the minimum wage is you raise the cost to the employer as one of their inputs towards the good or service that they create. This would consequentially raise the price or incentivize the employer to automate. Other than that, the reason that we have kind of not a whole lot of statistics that say, or not a huge significant statistic or job loss, or it doesn't wreck the economy when you raise the minimum wage, is because there's only a small fraction of the people in the country actually on the minimum wage. But what we do see is when you raise the minimum wage is it adversely affects the young and minorities. But what happens is what's really interesting is when you raise the minimum wage, at first you see a spike in the unemployment of the young and minorities, and then you see it kind of come back down a little bit. Well, why does that happen? Well, actually, the old demon inflation is actually causing the real cost of the minimum wage to go down in terms of the employer, so it allows for a little bit more hiring. So in one sense, you have the wages going up at the beginning, but then inflation brings the real wages down, which allows more people who were previously fired to get hired. Also, since our economy is still relatively productive in spite of everything the government and the Fed does to put shackles around the economy, production does create more job opportunities for the underprivileged or the low-skilled. So the idea that because the whole economy didn't crash because the minimum wage was raised is not a reason to raise the minimum wage. It praxeologically has an adverse effect on the people who work for low wages, the people who could work for low wages, their opportunities to compete in the market, and it also hurts employers because it raises their costs.
Yeah, you know what I heard? I heard it on, I think it was Jason Stapleton's show, and I never thought about it before until he called, you know, the employees, they are a business expense. I never thought of that before. Such a weird way to see it, but it really helps to paint the picture.
I can tell you that from my line of work, I've always worked for small businesses, and I've always been pretty vocal about these kind of things coming up, the minimum wage increase, et cetera. So, in my experience speaking with these companies that have 15, 16 employees. Their opinion of it was if minimum wage goes up, we're going to pick the people that mean the most, we're going to keep them, increase their wage, because of course if minimum wage is 15, somebody that's worth more than minimum is going to get paid 20. So their opinion on it was we'll cut the company in half and we'll let anyone that's expendable right there at that time go. And I can also tell you that just from a year that I worked with one company, they operated over 2 years without turning a profit because the majority of their money went to payroll, to paying out employees, because they paid well above minimum wage as it is now. So I can definitely see like a lot of these mom and pop businesses just going under if that was the case.
Yeah, it's really kind of a barrier to entry to small businesses because, of course, large corporations can handle these kinds of things. And especially unions like it because if you raise the minimum wage, it kind of prices union employees in the market a little bit better.
Well, geez, that goes right into my number one was the minimum wage.
Number two, Kim. Number two. Well, let's get it right. You guys are supposed to know numbers.
Well, I know numbers, but he was already on my topic of number one, so we're just going to rehash it by the time
Go
I get to number
it.
One.
Go for it.
What, so do I do my minimum wage topic then?
Don't do anything. I want to sit here in silence for the rest of the episode.
Some dinner. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Kim. Let's hear the minimum wage.
Well, Well, I mean, you were getting close to the topic of, you know, it does price people, like, pretty much out of the market, especially now. This, I guess, is easier for me to say, being a woman of African-American descent. It does tend to price teens out of the market, and sometimes, unfortunately, some people of minorities that, unfortunately, are in some neighborhoods out of the market, because there's a tendency for some people that have records in certain neighborhoods and people who didn't get a chance to go to college or finish school right out of the market with minimum wage being so high because they're looking for skilled workers. And I've been in a situation where I work in IT, and even most entry-level jobs in some states for IT, even help desk, starts out at $15. So could you imagine if they tried raising it and somebody who's entry-level IT making 15, they tried raising that, they would have to pay their entry-level people a pretty high price. So do you really think you want to pay your entry-level IT people that can have, you don't have to have a lot of skill to be a help desk person, but if you're going to start paying them anywhere from like $20 or so, you're going to start actually trying to put some barriers on that and start asking for some skills. So you're going to start pricing like a lot of people right out of there, and minimum wage actually hurts people, and people actually don't want to see that. I mean, because there's a lot of unseen, but you know, already we were seeing, of course, some Walmarts closing down in some places as soon as they started raising the minimum wage recently. And even my mom, who works in Las Vegas at Walmart, some stores started closing down and she got reshifted to another department completely. Because some Walmarts were closing down or cutting people because Walmart suddenly had to release people. So nobody sees that as they're raising minimum wage because, you know, nobody looks for that in the news. Only people who are looking around see it, but it does affect people. And, yeah, there's just signs of what happens when you do the minimum wage thing, but nobody pays attention to it. Nobody wants to. But then you also got people that don't have skills that end up stuck in a job at McDonald's forever because they unfortunately don't have the skills to move up much further. So there's a lot more that's detrimental that nobody wants to look at when you start raising the minimum wage.
Sure, I can't imagine what it does to the burger flipper instead of the fry guy at McDonald's too. If that guy's making 15, I can't imagine what they're going to want to pay everybody else up the chain. You know, I can't imagine how that's going to. Oof, that's got to hurt. Imagine yourself a business owner and like now they just went double digits straight into 15 and told you you got to pay everybody at that price.
And did you guys hear? Oh, I'm sorry, come go ahead.
And then of course what some people are probably hearing, they're like, oh my gosh, the greedy business people. And I'm like, now you got to think about this economically. It's not the fact that the person is thinking, oh man, I need to hang on to every dollar, because remember, you still have to produce for the consumer, which means you still got to be able to afford your producer goods, got to be able to afford your rent for the place. So now if you're forking out even more dollars for your workers, well, you got to still be able to churn out your burgers and everything for everybody's coming in there at lunch hour wanting like 8 million cheeseburgers. So you're like trying to figure out where you can cut your, you know, what you have to do. And like, you can't say, well, we need to make sure everybody and their mom is employed, so we want to like skimp on the burgers and have like a little sliver of patty on your damn cheeseburger, then all your consumers are going to be like, what the hell is this you put in front of me? So what do you got to, where you got to skimp? You're going to be like, well, Kim over there, she works fast, so maybe if we cut one person, have her flipping all the burgers and frying up the fries, she can handle that, and we can still get all the burgers and fries out, right? So, you know, that's what you have to think, because, you know, your business still has to run. You still have to make a profit, so it's not the business owner being greedy about it. There's a lot of aspects, and you have to think about where you can cut and still not end up in a deficit.
Oh, that's lovely. That's a lovely response. That was so well put together. There was like no, that was good. That was really, really nice. Yeah. I hope that makes sense to everybody that's listening. If it doesn't, again, you know where to go. Yeah. Christian, man, hit us, dude. Number two.
I think mine was the minimum wage, and then Kim chimed in.
Yep.
I think it's Kim's turn.
So, oh, my God.
We've messed up.
Oh, my God. Don't worry. I've got this. Go ahead. Go. You know what? Then let's switch it up. Christian, do your number one then.
My number one was trickle down.
My God, this dude.
We almost slightly share a brain sometimes.
Oh my God, I can see it. All right, well then, Kim,
you guys cheated.
Yeah, they you guys cheated. Notes. I'm telling. All right, Kim, then hit us with your number one. Do it.
Okay, actually, that was my number one. However, my number two. My number two was government redistribution is a good solution to solve income inequality. Of course, it is not. Now, the problem...
Say it again, I'm sorry.
Oh, I said... That's all good. I said government redistribution is a good solution to solve income inequality. Now, the fact that I would have to exactly explain that could... I mean, now... The problem is trying to figure out how in the world are you going to be able to do that fairly is the problem. Because what is everybody's fair share? Can you tell me? And what makes it possible to be able to take somebody's stuff from them? And just also, one of the, like, economics itself is basically the study of, you know, basically... taking scarce resources that have many uses and finding ways to allocate them, because the resources in the world, you know, that we use every day, unlike, you know, air, you know, as far as I know on the earth right now, air is just always in existence. That's far enough, all 32 years of my life, that's what I've known. However, things like money and all that, and food, clothing, all that stuff, you know, scarce resources. So trying to find ways to allocate these things, it's not easy, and they have lots of uses. So trying to figure out how we're going to shift things to certain people, it's just, it never really works, because especially when the government does it, is the problem, is they have not a single clue how to allocate things. They tend to pick a group that they want to please, and they try to redistribute them. Now, the problem is that in order to do this, you have to confiscate from somebody else. You're taking their personal property and giving it to somebody else. And, of course, we see a lot that is wrong with that. And it's taken from you involuntarily. But the problem is we don't exactly know what is a fair share for anybody, and you just shouldn't be able to do that to people. And the government pretty much is...
Can I stop you for a second, Kim? Because yeah. I don't want to just pass by this point, because I feel like a lot of people do. I call it theft. I call it theft. But for some reason, it's not resonating with people. What do you think that is, that people don't realize that you have to do it via force? They go, oh, yeah, force. It's theft. Yeah, no, it's theft. Yeah, but I'm, you know. What would you do to make that really stick? Is there something that you found that really sticks with people, that really lets them go,
I try to make it as personal as possible, because of, like, I found, obviously, if you try to say outright it's theft, it just does not work. Outside of, like, talking in a room with libertarians, it does not work. So I try to make it personal, and I say, okay, so if I was to walk into your home right now, and there was, say there was no barrier, I walked in, and I just started taking things out of your apartment, and they were your personal belongings, and I walked out with them, including your TV. I took food out of your kids' mouths, food out of your fridge, just everything. I just started taking stuff. And would you just let me do that? Most people would be like, hell no. You know, take the TV, take your smartphone, just take stuff out of there. You would not appreciate that, especially if I did it at gunpoint and just told you, I'm taking this stuff because it's my fair share. It's my right. You sign the social contract, I should be able to take whatever I want. Most people don't agree with that, because the problem is with government, you have that nice artificial layer where you don't see it. It's just being taken out of your paycheck and you don't see it. But when somebody walks in with a gun and just basically, this is my fair share, I'm taking whatever I want out of your house, out of your kids' mouths, out of your family's mouths, because this is my fair share, I can take it. When it's personal, somebody walks into your house and takes your possessions, it's personal. That is basically what you're doing to people. You are taking money out of their paycheck. They have worked hard to make that money. You're taking food out of that person's, like, out of their family's, like, just food out of their mouth, stuff that they could use. Maybe even somebody who has health issues, you are taking that right from them. They worked for it. You are actually taking that. And just because the government is there and you have that layer is not making that any different. So... you are still stealing from them. Just because you have that government layer, doesn't change it. You're taking
credit. Yeah, but I need it, Kim. I need it. What if the thief came back and offered me some, I don't know, healthcare as a...
healthcare? Well...
Yeah, what if the thief came back and tried to sell me some healthcare that I didn't want? Is that then okay?
I got it.
Christian, did you pipe in to answer that one?
Yeah, I got it. So people say, like, well, what if they steal from you, but they give you something in return? It's, you know, if a slave's working in the field, and then on Saturday the slave owner comes up and says, hey, we're gonna have karaoke night, and you're gonna get to have a roast chicken. The slaves don't all of a sudden sit there and say, ooh, yay, roast chicken and karaoke. They're like, I'm still a slave, you know?
yeah. You know, that's a little sad. I got to stop there for just one second because I get it. You know what I mean? And I understand. And, God, it really sucks. It feels like that part does not get across. I feel like I'm talking about the left when I say this, but they get that they want their sexual and moral independence, but it doesn't, you know, don't make laws that affect my body, but make laws that affect my wallet is fine.
It's not that they make laws. What the problem is that it's like the word terrorism. Now they can make something happen by saying it's a right.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it's just that word. They just throw that word in there and all of a sudden everyone's up in arms about it.
We don't have positive rights here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get what you earn, motherfucker.
Well, I mean, like, you have a right to eat, too, but you've seen how Venezuelan supermarkets work out, right?
Yeah, sure, and when you start letting the government dictate your fucking rights, they're gonna minimize them. It's like a company. They're gonna make the most profit they can with the least amount of effort they have to put out.
And, you know, and
go ahead, Karen.
I'm like, if they didn't put, like, does anybody notice, like, the third-party mechanism? If they were in the middle, that third-party mechanism being the government, maybe we might have more money. Like, if we didn't have that third party in there, might be able to have a little more control over that money.
Sure. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, like, we don't have enough money to pay for healthcare, but we have enough money to pay for a middleman and healthcare. I don't get it.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way to look at it. We don't have enough money to pay for healthcare, but we have enough money to pay for
to start a website
and a middleman. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I like that. You could definitely play with that idea, you know. But we have enough money for a middleman, right?
Yeah,
that's really good. Because I feel like part of that is trying to address the actual issues. Because I think the reason I wanted to do this episode was because people don't understand the basics to it, and they're not going to just by listening to this, but I almost wanted to put the idea in their head that maybe they're not considering an aspect of this. So, for example, I had a buddy over here, and I was down at the Young Americans for Liberty Convention down at Rutgers. While I was there, I took pictures and stuff, and I updated everything on the Facebook page, and I put pictures, and I put a picture up of Cato. And one of the attacks was like, oh, how could you, you love the Koch brothers and all this stuff, like those
grassroots campaign was the attack.
I put another one up of Americans for Prosperity, and it's like, you know, they're funded by the Koch brothers. And I said, well, just try to find a classical liberal movement that isn't funded by the Koch brothers. You know what I mean? They're not funded, but... you know, that they don't donate to as well. And is that the qualifier for what they're doing is right or wrong? So that doesn't really answer it. But I remember that he was sitting here in my house, and I had Soul's book up for Basic Economics, and he goes, I can never read that. Well, at the same time, you just admitted you could never read that or that you don't want to, but somehow you feel like you have the authority to speak on behalf of this. So part of this is trying to get people to understand that there's more that they're... well, that they're not understanding. That's why I wanted you guys to cover this, is to cover it from a realistic perspective that says, look, man, we're not greedy people out to take over the world. I think people need to get that, is that there's a math, that there's a science to this, and that perhaps, that maybe they're not right in in their assumptions, and they're not giving it credit. They're just destroying it, and, you know, with stupid little things like, oh, that's funded by the Koch brothers, which is another way of like, oh, there's smoke, there's fire, right? It's just another attack. It's not in any way a way of them trying to understand something that they don't know. That's why I was pretty much hell-bent on getting you guys to talk about it.
I don't know why the Koch brothers are held up as some kind of demon. They're like the 57th largest donors in American politics, and they've done more for traditionally progressive causes than many other progressive groups have actually done. So,
It's
the oil man.
That's what it is. It's the big man. And like you said, your friend wouldn't read the economics book.
Right.
And that's someone who's going to vote in November.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to vote for Bernie Sanders. And that's...
He didn't... I was like, dude, Cato's like a think tank. He's like, I don't like think tanks. But then later it found out he didn't know what the fuck a think tank was.
I don't like thinking. It has the word think in it.
I said, you could disagree with the science that they're doing, with the literature they're publishing. I say, but, you know, you should read all of them, right? You should read hard left, middle, right, far right. You should read everything that they do to try to get the best answers, right? Is to not be skewed in the way that you break down evidence. It's not astrology where I count the hits and discount the misses. You know, I only count things that prove me right, and everything that folks hold in my argument, I dismiss. I'm just finding a lot of that is that I watched this really great video by Jonathan Haidt, and it was called The Moral Roots of Liberals and Conservatives.
Oh, that was really good. I listened to that. It was really good.
Wasn't it good? I like that what he encourages is that we get too deep into our in-group, into our moral psychology, that we become teams or flag wavers. You know, we brand ourselves with such and such cause, and then we defend it to no end. But that's not really how you get at what's right. What you get at what's right is going after the answers. Like, you know, I'm a dum-dum, but I still try to go after what's right, what I see. And not that I have it. But I feel like people don't want to do that. They don't want to poke holes in their argument. What do you think that is, man? Or lady?
I think they just...
Well, they don't...
Oh.
They don't want to research. They don't, they, like when I told the, you know, this one Bernie fan, I said, hey, you know, you want to talk over this? They don't want to talk to you about it. They don't want to talk to the other side. They just want to be vindicated because it's kind of like a game to them, because we've not had like super terrible things happen to us. We've been so sheltered with our lifestyle and our place in the world that we think that it doesn't matter what we do. You know, if we vote for this person in power, it's just a game, and it's just, I really don't. They just don't. They don't want to learn.
I agree.
But I also have another myth.
Go ahead.
Yeah, because Kim went first, so then I think I missed out on one. And this is a big one. It's my number two. So
let's hear it.
The myth that the free markets cause depressions and recessions.
Oh yes, good one.
And you hear a lot of this as like, oh, the housing bust. And you'll see it circulate on Facebook with Elizabeth Warren's ugly mug on top of the meme. And she says, sign this petition to help us bring back Glass-Steagall, as if the repeal of two paragraphs of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1997 signed by Bill Clinton had something to do with the housing bust. And all Glass-Steagall, the paragraphs that were repealed, really did was it allowed different banks to be able to consolidate under the same branch. And you know what's funny? The rest of the world had their own little recession to go along in 2008, and none of them had had Glass-Steagall or their variants of Glass-Steagall for 50 years, whether it be Canada or Europe. So it's such a paper tiger. And when people ask me this question, I say, well, yeah, well, what about the rampant inflation and carteling of businesses, special subsidies to farms in the 1920s, and what about the government insistence that everyone be able to own a home, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as quasi-government entities, and the lowering of interest rates? The idea that the free market causes recessions is just ridiculous.
That's beautiful. I almost want to hear you say it again. You know, one more time.
Did I get cut off? Is that why?
No.
You didn't get cut off. I said it was beautiful. I wanted you to say it again. I know how. Dude, like, I get how people on the left and people on the right, let's not, you know, forget the right sucks too. Everyone sucks, but the right sucks too. Is that you can make a point, they'll hear the words, but they don't get it. And almost like I feel like, no, I'm going to say it one more time so that you really get it. Like, listen. Like, don't view it through your lens.
Yeah.
Just listen. Like, yep. Just actually listen. Like, try to learn. And then if you disagree, try to find out why and try to have it not be an emotional argument. I would love for that to be the case.
Yeah, free work.
Like, attack the points that I'm saying. Because I try to give the liberals or conservatives, the progressives or the conservatives, the benefit of the doubt by actually respecting them and attacking the points that they say instead of just trying to revert to my talking points.
Yeah.
Right. One's parroted and then one comes from truly understanding, but how can you understand it if... See, because that makes it harder, because I want to sympathize with Bernie fans to see, like, all right, I get it. They want what they think is best. I don't think they're coming from a bad place. I do think that they're ignorant. I do think that the majority of their, if not most, of their arguments are emotional. They bring emotion into a reasoned dialogue, and that doesn't help move the ball. And they're not willing to understand. I get it. It seems huge, a topic like economics. They might not want to consider it, but then that doesn't give you authority to be outraged at something that you don't understand, because you can't say, I don't want to know about it, I don't understand it. Robert Reich did a 5-second clip on YouTube, and now I get it. Like, that's not exactly how it works. So
all those videos.
Go ahead, Kim.
No, I was just sighing. I was just sighing because, you know... Me trying to listen to talking points so that I can understand them, I watched those videos, and I listened to them. I mean, not there was much. I looked at all the drawings, and everything, and I was like, you know, he says just enough to almost make it seem like it could possibly be true, just barely enough, but still come out false. And I'm just like, no, that's not how economics works. That's just not, no.
He's the worst.
It's the worst. And also, I just got to say, free markets are also, free markets are not all responsible for our healthcare situation either. Like, I'm going to give people a clue. Free markets does not involve government. So
now, Christian, you said he's the worst, though, right? So if I mentioned Krugman right now, you wouldn't want to take back that statement?
No, Reich is worse than Krugman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, at least Krugman could admit. He was like, oh, I'm sorry, guys. Bernie Sanders' healthcare plan is not going to work. Even Krugman was like, I can't even, Keynes that shit. That's not going to work. Sorry, guys. I can't even make that work.
I Keynes even, man. That's like slang. I Keynes even. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I'm going to have to use that. I Keynes even, man. I Keynes
even. There you
even.
Go. Make sure you spell it right, and someone who's good at making memes could really kill it with that.
I'm going to have to talk to Amy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true. Oh, all right. Let's see. I got to check the time, because we only do an hour on this, fellas and lady. I keep forgetting. We got like 5 minutes left, so why don't we do this? Guys, I really want to give you the ball. I want to let you run with it.
Make some really good closing points.
Yeah, well, obviously, don't make bad ones.
That's typically what's on this show. So.
What do you want to be the takeaway? You know, if you had to do your Jerry Springer final words, if we will. What would your final words be? Like, give us something good, man. Let us reflect.
Christian, you first.
Okay. So the number one thing I would say is just read. Just start with something simple. Just read. Start with economics in one lesson. Start with the Candlemaker's Petition. It's a short satire by Frederick Bastiat. It's hilarious. Just start reading the material and formulating your own opinions. Don't be afraid to watch Robert Reich's videos. They're actually quite funny as much as they're frustrating. Don't be afraid to enter into a debate, because even if you get proven wrong, you run into an argument that you never heard before, and you look at how to defeat that the next time. Don't be afraid to actually get into the source material and read about it. Don't be intimidated by the size. And honestly, just like and this goes for progressives, conservatives, and even libertarians. Murray Rothbard said that it's not a crime to be opinionated, but it's absolutely a crime to be so loud and vociferously opinionated on something you're so ignorant about. So if you're going to go in and start talking about economics, you better make sure that you've read all the works you can. And not only that, but you know their argument better than they know their own argument. So that's what I would say.
Christian, you're going to send me some show notes too, and I want that quote because I'm going to put it in the show notes.
Which quote?
The one by Rothbard.
Kim? I would say one of the things, if you want to jump into it, of course, Christian put out some economics in one lesson, but one of the things I want to point out, if maybe you don't want to jump into your reading just yet, even though I would encourage that, there's a podcast I definitely love. It's called Contra Krugman, and Tom Woods and Bob Murphy going through Paul Krugman's column, New York Times column, every week, and they go through, and they're not always just criticizing Krugman, because they do agree when with some of his points. Every now and then, they're not always, because sometimes he does say things that are correct. So they go through that, and you learn economics that way. Also, one of the other audiobooks I would suggest, Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell. He explains that stuff. It's a really long audiobook, but I like taking it, digesting it, like, you know, when I'm walking around, going for a run, doing something, just digesting. He explains it in the most, common, way that anybody can understand. And I just say, no matter what your political leanings are, just when you hear something, any candidate spouting anything that sounds interesting to you, just sit down and try to think about the aspects of everybody, not just yourself, but how this would affect everybody, this policy that they're talking about, not just you, but everybody around you, because there's a lot of unseen as well. Like, if we were to try to implement this policy, what do you think it's going to do now, and how do you think it's going to affect the future? Because trust me, it's going to affect something in the future. So just always keep your eyes open. Challenge any and everything. You should always be questioning any and everything, including everything we've said on this podcast. It'll help you out in the long run.
I couldn't agree more. All right, guys, we'll call it there. Again, thanks to the newborn libertarians, Christian, Kim. You guys are fantastic. Both beautiful people, and both absolutely unbelievably brilliant, smart, whatever the words. They're not coming out right now. So, guys, we're going to call it now, all right?
All right. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.